Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm Grace Wan. These days, there seems to be an app for everything, and mental health is no exception. Experts estimate that there are as many as 10,000 apps to address mental health and self-care needs available for download. It's easy to understand why. Mental health care has become increasingly difficult to access, and a recent study suggests that by 2025, there will be a severe shortage of therapeutic providers. And yet another study shows that insured patients are increasingly having to go out of network to find a therapist, even though a federal law requires that insurance companies provide equal access to physical and mental health care. Against this backdrop, more Americans are looking to their apps to find a way to answer their mental health care needs. Will a robot and an algorithm replace your therapist? What's the direction that digital technology is taking us? Here to talk to me in the studio about this new trend in digital technology and mental health care, I have Alisa Chaikoff, the Clinical Implementation Manager at Recovery Record. Welcome, Alisa.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I also have Christy Choi, who's a marriage and family therapist, and she is a provider for an app called Talkspace.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, nice to have you. And on the phone, I have Dr. Barr Taylor, who's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences emeritus at Stanford, and also a research professor and director of the Center for M-Squared Health at Palo Alto University. Hi, Dr. Taylor.
Oh, hi.
Great to have you.
Super to be here.
In 20 minutes, we'll open our phone lines for you to join the conversation. You can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us with a question at cityvisions@kalw.org. We're also on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Are you using a mental health app to deal with an issue in your life? Is it working? What's your favorite app? Call us with any of your questions. So I'd like to start off by just talking about what the landscape looks like in the mental health care world. And I'm going to start with you, Barr. In terms of what's out there, if I'm a person looking to get some health care and using a digital app, what kinds of apps would I find?
Oh, gosh. You know, as you mentioned there, according to the World Health Organization, 10,000 apps are pretty much apps for absolutely everything. One of the things that we'll probably want to talk about is just how you think about the credibility of an app and choosing the app you want to help you with a problem. I actually think there's a really good resource that I wouldn't mind telling people about, if that's okay.
Oh, yeah, please do.
It's called CyberGuide, spelled with a PSYCERGUIDE. And you can look up CyberGuide and get some information about what the apps are that could help you with a particular problem. It also provides information on the credibility of the app, whatever kind of research may be behind it, and other issues like privacy. So I think we're in the middle of a revolution in terms of apps being used to help people for much of the reasons that you had mentioned. I mean, if you look at the United States, about in the course of a year, about 25% of people have mental health problems. We know that very few of these people actually get care. Problems of cost and access are huge, so many of us in the field are really excited about providing opportunities for people to use apps to help them with their mental health problems. But again, we all know that there's a bewildering array of apps out there.
Right. Luckily, we have two people in our studio who work with apps, and I'm going to move to you, Christy Choi. You are a licensed marriage therapist, or licensed therapist, a family marriage therapist, and you provide assistance on Talkspace. Can you tell us a little bit about that app?
Yes. So I work with clients on Talkspace, and basically Talkspace is an app that people can sign up. It's kind of like a service that they can sign up, and they can choose the kind of service that they want. And I work with clients on there, and I check in on the app 5 days a week, and clients can have access to the chat room anytime, so they can write anything anytime, and they can also record the messages, or we can also schedule video sessions on Talkspace as well.
So that's an app where your clients, are they texting you, or are you having video chats regularly? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Most of them text me. Some of them request video sessions once in a while. But, yeah, most of my clients tell they prefer texting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And another person we have in our studio, Alisa Chaikoff, you work with Recovery Record. Can you tell us a little bit about that app?
Sure. So Recovery Record is made specifically for individuals with eating disorders. There's two different apps, actually. There's one for clinicians and one for individuals with eating disorders. And so it's really about that asynchronous care in between sessions. So with you meet with your therapist and then in between engaging in CBT meal monitoring and other types of evidence-based monitoring so that when you meet with your therapist, you can go over, you know, what's been going on in between those sessions rather than having to do that recall work in session.
And you mentioned something called CBT. What's that?
Sure. So cognitive behavioral therapy is an evidence-based form of treatment that's been used across a wide array of mental health concerns, and it's really about understanding how your cognitions lead to certain behaviors in a short way of explaining it.
And is Recovery Record kind of steeped in that cognitive behavior therapy, or does it address different types of therapies?
Sure. So it's really built for clinicians to use it in whatever way they want. However, the meal monitoring is based in cognitive behavioral monitoring, and then we provide other evidence-based skills that are based in dialectical behavior therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy. So DBT and ACT, as us therapists like to call it. We like lots of acronyms.
Yeah. And what about Talkspace? What approaches do you use in that therapy app?
I think it depends on the therapist. And then for me, I'm a relational psychodynamic therapist. And then so I integrate my own approach. I'm also transpersonal psychotherapist. So I actually do a lot of integrations of a different approach and work with clients. And on Talkspace, you can find all kinds of clinicians there. There are different people with different kind of specialties. So, yeah, that's a pretty broad range of therapists that's on that site.
I think most people think of therapy kind of if you haven't had therapy, what you see on TV or in the movies, and that's just you sitting on a couch one-on-one with a therapist. And so it might feel a little strange to be texting a therapist. Tell me a little bit, Christy Choi, about how your clients feel about it. Did they like it? Would they rather meet you in person?
Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, I usually offer 10-minute sessions to do face-to-face so that we can actually see each other face-to-face. And then they actually like writing because it's kind of nice for them to be able to sit with the emotions and feelings. And some people actually express themselves better in writing, and I like to write as well. So it's kind of it works really well for some people, I would say.
Yeah, so being able to write down your emotions just in a text form, is it just me using my phone and using the group text sort of feature on my phone, or is there something special with Talkspace?
Talkspace has their app, and you can also access that on the computer. I do that on the computer because it's faster for me to type on the computer.
Sure.
Yeah, and clients can do either way, and then that's the app also have their own video sessions and the recording messages, so they can also talk and record me a voice message if they want to.
Well, Barr Taylor, so we're hearing about how these two different apps operate, but you've done some research on digital apps and digital therapy. Is it effective? Does it work?
It's a great question. Let me just frame it a little broadly because it really depends on what kind of app you're using. So one of the challenges of the field is that if people download and use apps on their own, if they're very dedicated, they probably work. But a lot of evidence suggests that most people, like 95%, will only use an app as a self-help tool for a week or less. So by 2 or 3 weeks, about 97% of people have stopped using most of the apps. On the other hand, if you have a guided self-help, that is to say you have a coach who's helping you with it, as I think both of these folks are talking about what we'd call guided self-help, the outcomes are actually looking pretty good. It depends a little bit on the situation, but there is a lot of evidence that would suggest that a guided self-help program, either directed by a therapist face-to-face or even a coach therapist online, achieves comparable results to seeing a therapist in person. So that's very, encouraging. Also has to be noted that a lot of the programs deal with problems that are fairly straightforward, like simple anxiety and depression and stress and things like that. And more complicated problems probably would benefit from some face-to-face contact. But the good news is that we're seeing really good outcomes for a lot of these programs that are affordable and accessible. And I would also note that worldwide, the kind of revolution in digital mental health is occurring much more rapidly than in the United States. So in countries like Sweden, it's standard practice to offer individuals blended or therapy guided in part by a therapist with the use of an app to sort of facilitate the therapy process.
I feel like we should all move to Sweden. Sweden always seems to have the best stuff going on. Tell me, Alyssa, on Recovery Record, what's your, sorry to use the word, track record in terms of good results or results for your patients and clients?
Yeah, so we've done several clinical trials and even worked with the NIMH on a grant to look at the app in a self-help capacity because I know I'm kind of diverting from your question, but about 30% of our users have not told one person that they had an eating disorder.
Wow.
So although the app was not intended to be used in a self-help capacity, we wanted to see what the effectiveness was, and it actually got great results. So we're really dedicated to research. We have a bunch of research partnerships, including with Stanford. So hi, Stanford, on the phone. you know, and it's not just about, is this app effective? It's also, we have at this point over 850,000 individuals with eating disorders using the app. So we have, you know, of what I know, the biggest amount of individuals with eating disorders in one place that we can really get some information about effective treatments for eating disorders. So we've seen either clients maintain where they are or improve with standardized measures.
I want to pick up on something you said, that 30% of your users have not told anybody in their mm-hmm. lives that they have an eating disorder. So are apps a good way, if you're keeping that secret or whatever your issue is an app a good entryway into starting to resolve your problem if you don't have a therapist and you don't want to talk to anybody? Are you finding that your patient base sort of moves to the app first before they actually talk to a real-life person?
Yeah, a lot of people do. And actually, looking at the app and looking at the goals and skills and different behaviors that the clients can report on, you know, whether it's specific to their eating disorder or with shame, they find that it's normalizing. Oh, I didn't know other people experienced what I experienced. I thought I was the only one, you know, with binge eating disorder, as an example. And we get reports all the time from clients and from clinicians that the client will come and say, I use this app. Now I recognized I needed to work with a therapist. So it does serve as a stepping stone, which is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And have you seen something similar, Christy, with Talkspace, that people want to move away from just using the Talkspace app to actually seeing a therapist in person? Or
yes, there were a few of clients that actually asked me if I can see them in person. They were like, oh, I actually want to do this in person. And at that time, I didn't have my private practice going, so I couldn't do that. But there were some that was kind of recognizing that, oh, yeah, actually, I do want to talk to somebody.
Yeah, that it helps actually to see someone.
Mm-hmm.
And what about, Barr, you know, you were saying that there's an app for almost every kind of situation. And it seems like these apps are good for either maintenance or kind of recording thoughts and feelings. But are they good for crises?
Well, sure. You know, we have not exactly an app, but a crisis text line, and some of these services, and in some ways could be seen as an app that's still a little bit web-based, serve a huge population. I mean, these kind of suicide prevention programs have been used by millions of people with some evidence that they actually do very well in crises. A lot of apps, for instance, a PTSD app and some that we've helped develop with the VA, offer connections where you can begin to identify people in your social support network who can help you in other ways, and many are designed actually to make referral if you're having difficulty. So there are algorithms often that would indicate that it's appropriate to seek extra help. I don't think it's necessarily a first step for everybody, but in the context of some really very usable coping tools, apps can be very helpful.
And did you say that there are algorithms that were being used to sort of monitor? Tell us a little bit about how that works.
Well, there's was recently an article in the New York Times about companies in the Bay Area that are in the mental health area, including apps. There were almost 50 different startups, and almost all of these companies talk about the use of apps. So as an example, when people are communicating a crisis, there can be an algorithm that pays attention to the type of words that they are using that may indicate that they're more suicidal or more at risk, and then can refer people or add other information or resources when this information is being monitored. In general, and I know that with Recovery Record, they do this all the time, one of the really exciting things about apps is the ability to personalize. So there are two sides to that. One, there's a lot of information about who we are and what we say that are being recorded by these apps, and as consumers, we have to be incredibly careful about that. But at the same time, it's possible for people to have information collected about their own experience that will tell them things that can be very helpful for their getting better. So, for instance, with people who are depressed, there are apps that monitor how much activity people have, and there's a strategy called behavioral activation, which simply is trying to get people to be more active through exercise, meeting other people, and so forth. And the monitoring can be fed back to an individual to encourage them to increase their activity levels, and doing so has been shown to actually have a pretty good effect on reducing depression.
Wow. You touched a little bit on something that I think we're all starting to think more about when we think about our digital lives and worlds, which is privacy, and the fact that these apps may or may not be collecting information about us. Alyssa, can you tell us about how at Recovery Road, you guys handle the privacy issues?
Absolutely. So we are very proud to be HIPAA compliant and follow all of the rules set forth by HIPAA. And all of the data that is collected is encrypted in transit. And while it's rested, we don't sell the data to anyone. People can also use the app without registering an account if they want, so we wouldn't be collecting any sort of data if they don't feel comfortable. And people can also choose to delete their data. Mm-hmm. And for clinicians have to enter a 4-digit code every single time that they enter their app. So those are a couple of ways that we protect people's information.
And you said that people don't have to share their data with you. Are you using the data that you said you had 850,000 mm-hmm. patients? How does the data that you have collected be used, or are you not collecting it at all?
So if we are taking part in a research partnership, we will de-identify the person's information, so they'll be assigned a number. So for example, we're working with UNC and Apple Watches to detect binge episodes. So the participants who choose to participate are assigned a number.
Oh, and so it's you get to choose if you want to be part of that or not.
Correct.
Oh, that's good. And what about Talkspace? If I am sharing my information with you on the Talkspace app and the texts, what happens to my data?
I'm not really clear on the data part because I'm a therapist on the psych, so I don't participate in that. But like what I know about the app is that it's HIPAA compliance. Say I schedule a video session with a client, I can only do that through the app because only that channel is HIPAA compliance. And if clients say, "Oh, can we do like FaceTime or anything like that," I would not be able to do that.
There has to be there's a downside that we all might feel about privacy and how our data is being used. But as a research scientist, there must be some benefit for the collection of this data through these apps in terms of what you're able to figure out and how we might learn to address mental health care in the future.
Absolutely. We just finished a study with 700 women with eating disorders from 28 colleges. We were using a program that was a Coast Guided Health program, so it was an app that was provided by another company. And from that data, we could begin to look at all kinds of really important issues. Now, the use of HIPAA was mentioned before, so I think everyone is aware or should be aware that all medical information is meant to be protected and not to be shared without people being willing to disclose it to other individuals. So in a research study, it's relatively easy to do. We have very closed data sets that are designed so that we don't identify particular individuals. But from that information, you can find such things as what are the components of a program that really work for people and what are the characteristics. So sometimes we found, for instance, that too much self-disclosure early on in a program can be a little bit difficult for some people. They would prefer to sort of slip into a program a little bit more gradually. You can also look at time of use. So with our work with eating disorders, we find a lot of these apps are used late at night. And so you have to begin to think about what is the context of that person being there late at night using the program, and is this a time when you might add some features that could help them cope with whatever is going on. Or another example is that the use of ecological momentary assessment, that study that Recovery Records are doing at UNC, means that we keep track of everything people are doing. So you may find that you're much more likely to binge a problem with eating disorders at a certain period of time, and that knowing that, you can then be told by the app to get some tools to prepare you to deal with the binging rather than proceeding in a way that you may feel a loss of control. Layered on all of this is a whole other area in this sort of digital mental health space, which is using all kinds of information about people, including such things as search histories and what kind of videos people are looking at that can be informative. We don't tend to collect that data because we consider it beyond what we would want to for privacy reasons. But in the future, I think it's going to be a whole collection and sources of information that could be very informative for an individual about the kinds of things that can help them in ways that they may not have been able to just notice on their own.
It's exciting and a little tricky, too. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. In the studio here, we're talking about digital apps and how they're being used in mental health care. I have Alisa Chakoff, the Clinical Implementation Manager at Recovery Record, Christy Choi, a marriage and family therapist and a Talkspace provider. And on the phone, I have Dr. Barr Taylor. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences emeritus from Stanford University. We'd love to hear your calls and your questions and comments. Are you using an app for mental health care? If so, what's one of your favorites? Give us a call. The number to call is 1-866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-TALK. You can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website or Facebook page. We're also on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. So before that little break, we were talking about privacy and how data is being used. I think another aspect of the digital apps is that you don't have to be in the same city as your therapist. And I think that's what's been happening for you, Christy, right?
Yeah, so I'm licensed in California, so I can work with any people in California. And Talkspace somehow also sent me like people from other countries as well. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for your overseas clients, is it the same? Did they just work through the app?
Yes.
Yeah. And I think you were talking earlier about how some of your clients prefer almost to write than to talk, and that the writing aspect is somewhat is therapeutic in and of itself. How have you found that being a provider?
For me, I like it because I'm a writer on the side. So it's kind of natural to me like to read and to write my response. So like, I guess it works for me as well.
Yeah. And with Recovery Record, it must be the same. People write about the feelings and the moments that they're having. And do you find that the people who are really comfortable using it tend to be younger or older? Is it across the board?
Well, what's really interesting is I would have thought that it would have really only been like the teenagers that were using the app, right? But we actually see people across the different categories of ages using it. The average age is 27.8 years old, but we have from the age of 13, which is the youngest that we're allowed to go with all sorts of laws and rules, which we agree with, up to 78 years old. So people are using it across the lifespan. The majority, however, are under 30 years old.
And I think that's great. Mm-hmm. So unfortunate that you have somebody that old who's struggling with an eating disorder.
Yeah.
So do you find that your clients check in? I think Barr was talking about at all hours of the day. Is that true? And are you be able to respond to them in real time?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's really up to clinicians how they want to use the app. Some clinicians are more plugged in than others. A lot will just check the app right before or during session with their clients. And then intermittently throughout the week, they'll engage in something we call intermittent random reinforcement, which really allows for the continued use of the app. So just to give you an example, what a clinician can do is comment on a log that a client writes about a thought that they're having about their mom, as an example. And they can respond, you know, great job using your coping skills. And they can send that at a Tuesday at 4 p.m. Then next week, they might comment on something Monday morning, you know, great start to the week, looking forward to seeing you later. And by commenting and responding to particular logs, and again, being really personalized with it, it can really help people continue to use the app.
And you were saying it's intermittent. It's sort of picking random times, not mm-hmm. a specific regular time to check in.
Yeah, it's one of those things that if you're expecting the gold sticker at Friday at 4 p.m., you might do what you need to do. Thinking of a kiddo at school, you might do what you need to do on Friday, but maybe not on Monday. And so by doing it randomly, it can really help to promote the positive behaviors or the healthy behaviors that we would call it in eating disorder recovery.
And I think that goes into a comment that you made, Barr, which is, here on Recovery Record, you've got a person on the other end who's encouraging you to stick with that app. And that I think you had mentioned that there's a big fall off on app use, that people download the app and then they stop using it. Do you think apps can only be effective if there's somebody on the other side?
No, I think that for some people, the 3 to 5% who continue using the app, they probably get an enormous benefit. One thing, we don't really understand this process, but for users out there, I think that it's important to do a little bit of self-assessment about what you want to do with the app and how you're going to commit yourself to it. Apps tend to be fairly inexpensive, and there's a lot of just try it out and not use it. And that's probably one reason that people don't stick with them for some time. So I think if you're going to be using a self-help app, I think people should spend a little time thinking, well, what am I going to get out of this? What do I want? And commit themselves to using it for arbitrarily 3 or 4 weeks to see if it's going to be a benefit. There is some reason to think if people do that, they're going to have a better outcome. So it really is quite individual. I wanted also to make a comment about the notion of the texting, the responding to texting, that one of my colleagues from a postdoc from Sweden did a study with adolescents with pretty serious depression. And the way they structured this, the kids who were part of the trial did the recording that you've heard about over a period of a week. And then they had a structured interaction with a therapist at the end of the week for about a half an hour. And then they went and asked these kids what they thought about the interaction. And by their report, they really loved this texting interaction, chatting online for a very specified time at a predetermined time. And then they looked at how the kids thought of the relationship with the therapist. And the reports from the teenagers were pretty much what you would see if they were being seen by a face-to-face therapist. They had actually a strong therapeutic alliance with the individuals who were helping them, even though they had actually never seen them or met them face-to-face. So there are many combinations, and as the field is developing and expanding opportunities, I think people will have choices whether they want to have a structured interaction, whether they want to have a structured interaction with a face-to-face, like a Skype call or a Zoom call or FaceTime, whether they would simply prefer to have some continued, what we call asynchronous chatting, where they bring up issues all the time and the therapist responds. So we're in the process of trying to develop models that meet people's different kinds of needs and interests. And I'm very optimistic that we're going to have a lot of ways to provide services to people that are really super.
That's fascinating. And Christy, do you find with you seem to have like a practice, and then you have the talk space. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you're always on because somebody could be texting you, and then you have your face to face clients? Is it more burdensome or more fulfilling? And how do you balance both of those?
I actually do like my talk space practice as I learned how to do this. Because what it's important is for us to have our own structure. Talkspace work as it's not like an instant texting messages, so I'm not like supposed to be responding when my clients write me. So what I do is that in the beginning, I'll let them know what's the expectations, like, so that they can write anytime during the day, 24/7, and I'll check in at a specific time each day so that they know what to expect from me. So, and then I also can kind of schedule my day that way.
And are your clients as attached to you as what Barr was saying, that even without the face-to-face, the clients attached to their therapist, do you find that to be the case?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a fair amount of them. Actually, I have some that was stuck with me for over a year, so.
And what is the average time that people stick with a Talkspace?
Some of them kind of couple months, and there are some that just don't really find it, I guess, working for them, so they left. But there are some that like will stick for, I have a few that stick over a year.
Oh, that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Well, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking about digital therapy apps. And in the studio, I have Alyssa Chaikoff, who's the clinical implementation manager of Recovery Record, an app that is focused on eating disorders. We also have Christy Choi, a marriage and family therapist and Talkspace provider. And on the phone, Dr. Barr Taylor, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University and also a research scientist at Palo Alto University. Please feel free to call in with your questions or comments. Is there a digital app that you're using? Is there a mental health care issue that you face that technology has helped you resolve? Give us a call at 1-866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-TALK. Or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website or Facebook page and reach us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Christy, you were saying when we talked earlier that one of your clients loves the texting feature because it feels like having a live diary.
Yeah, like someone wrote, and we have like the rating and then the feedback, and someone wrote was saying that my therapy with her is kind of like, I'm assuming that's a her because I'm kind of like imagining that's that client that wrote it. She said it's kind of like a journal that talks back to me. Yeah.
And have you had that kind of feedback for Recovery Record that your clients are saying like, oh, you know, there's this, I have this instantaneous response from, or intermittent response from my therapist, which makes it feel so good.
Yeah, they'll say, you know, it feels like I have my therapist on my shoulder. And, you know, it's really in those moments of need when they're feeling distressed or, you know, the eating disorder urges are coming to them that it's really nice to have their therapist there. And what's really fantastic, too, is our clients, for clients, it's always free to have Recovery Record, and they can continue to use the app and have their historical data when they go to higher levels of care if they so need it. And that information will then transfer if they go back to their original therapist. So there's no need to re-explain what's been going on in between that time.
I think that's pretty helpful for mm-hmm. your clients. And are there, do your clients use apps other or in addition to Recovery Record? Do you know, or is that just the primary app that they use for their therapy?
So typically they'll just use Recovery Record. Within in Recovery Record, there's a meditation feature. So some of the apps that are out there for meditation, we've built that directly in. They can, the therapist can assign them meditations at certain days, certain times, and the clients can do that for themselves. So an example is if breakfast is a really triggering time, they can set meditations for themselves and put specific words in there. Yeah, the other thing that our clients will do is that we have an app called Nourishly, which looks pretty similar to Recovery Record, functions in a similar way. It's really designed for other eating needs. You know, so if a client really feels like they're good with their eating disorder, have that under control, they can just use Nourishly for general wellness.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were talking about how apps are pretty inexpensive, so that's one reason why people use that instead of going to an actual therapist. Mm-hmm. Is Recovery Record something that clients are charged for?
So clients are not charged for using Recovery Record, and clinicians can link with one client for free, and then there's different subscription options that are really affordable. We're mission-driven. We want to get this in the hands of providers, especially, you know, as you're saying, there's so many clients out there and the amount of therapists are, you know, not as much. So we just want to get this in as many people's hands as we can at an affordable price.
That's great. And what about Talkspace? Is it expensive or how does that work?
I don't really know the price, honestly, because I'm like on the other end. But I know that there are different plans, though. There are plans that it's kind of unlimited message, and there are plans that's maintenance. So like those plans cost less. It's mm-hmm. kind of like once a week check-in versus 5 days a week check-in.
And something I've noticed, Barr, is that just looking online about this, is that a lot of employers and colleges, and you mentioned the VA, are really trying to connect their students or their patients with apps as a form of healthcare. Is that a trend that you're seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. Another resource, by the way, is the VA has developed a whole set of really fantastic apps that deal with all kinds of problems, including sleep and trauma. They tend to be self-help apps that are free and have been very well developed, and many of them have been evaluated. So listeners may want to look at that website to sort of find out whether there's a resource that in the VA that they may want to use. One of the things that we know is that most people have two or three apps on their phone, and mental health apps. And one of the things we need to be thinking about as mental health professionals is how we facilitate with our clients the use of apps that may be even different than what we're primarily focused on in therapy. So I'm a therapist, and suppose I don't do work with sleep particularly. There's a huge advantage for me having one of my clients, for instance, use the VA app and then facilitating how they're using it, getting information about problems they're having and being supportive. Because the number of apps that will be available through, for instance, I think that either CVS bought one of these sleep apps, and they will be offering it to all of their customers for free. Colleges and universities have, most of them, developed a set of apps that students can use for any number of variety of problems. And there's a commitment on a lot of institution parts other institutions in order to make a variety of apps available to people. I think this is great. I do worry that one thing that can happen is that people will be using apps with not a huge commitment to them, or they may have benefit from having someone help them get more out of the app and become a little bit discouraged, seeing it sort of as a quick fix. But I just realized in reading some college and university, because we're doing some studies with another guided self-help program for anxiety, depression across, eventually we'll screen a couple hundred thousand people, that in fact apps are available in many universities and many healthcare settings, and people use them a lot.
Well, you're giving me incentive to go back to my meditation app, that's for sure. I definitely dropped off on that. I don't know. I don't think I gave it the 3 to 4 weeks that you suggested, Barr. I saw you nodding your head when Barr was talking about how apps are being used in the college setting. Alyssa, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, we get requests from universities, from athletic departments, you know. Eating disorders don't discriminate, as you know, other mental health conditions don't as well. And so I just think it's so great that we're reaching out, and universities are seeing the need for the students. I was going to say clients, just my therapist brain, for the students. And, you know, everyone has their phones. You know, not everyone has a smartphone, but most college students, if you go on a campus, they're all looking down at their phone. You know, what's a way that's not socially confronting to have them get the help that they need, but with an app?
Mm-hmm. And that phrase socially confronting, do you mean that it's a little bit easier to confide to your app than it might be to a real life person initially, going back to how people keep eating disorders secret sometimes?
Yeah, so for that first step, and also for individuals with eating disorders and working toward recovery, it's really important to take track of what's going on with your meals and snacks. So being able to take a picture of, you know, your sandwich is pretty normal. You see people doing that all the time if their food looks pretty or whatever it might be, you know, taking pictures of their meals. So, you know, if I'm sitting at a cafe, I probably wouldn't think twice about person A versus person B taking a photo and typing some things in. And one of those people may be working toward recovery from an eating disorder. Whereas if you are taking out a sheet of paper at a meal, you know, people might look at you, you might, you know, experience some shame. So having the smartphone app really takes away some of that.
You mean because in the old days, one would be taking out a piece of paper to log what he or she was eating versus take a picture on the phone, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've even tried to do it kind of like walking a mile in my client's shoes, and it's really challenging to do.
Yeah, I could imagine that. Go ahead.
Eating disorders, we've done some surveys that a lot of the people who would benefit from therapy actually prefer to have an online program, in part because of the issue of stigma. In general, when you're doing therapy, I think people are certainly as open to therapists as they are, or more so than they are to an app. The problem is whether they're going to actually go and see a therapist. So just to repeat what's sort of been said at another level, we work with the National Eating Disorder Association. We screen about 500,000 people. And with our screen, about 80% of the folks have significant problems with eating disorders, and fewer than 25% of them actually have ever received a therapy, but a large number of them would actually look at other sorts of resources like Recovery Record, which is actually offered through NIDA as a way to deal with problems. There are, of course, many other things where people don't feel quite the same stigma, but when work we did in India where there basically is like one psychiatrist for 100,000 people and mental health resources are pretty sparse, we found that when we went to some of the universities there that the students most appreciated the fact that they could communicate with someone. We did a coached online program that wasn't self-help, with privacy, with respect for who they are, and without any issues of stigma. So being able to provide interventions for groups that feel stigmatized, I think, are incredibly important. I personally generally favor a kind of blended therapy where there's a coach or a therapist paying attention to what's going on. Eventually, with sophisticated algorithms, self-help programs are and will continue to include a lot of transactions that are being generated by the computer that seem like therapy. I do actually quite a bit of work in this place, and I want to reassure the therapists out there that we're a long ways from replacing therapists with any of these algorithms, but the fields are moving in that direction pretty quickly.
Well, that takes me to a listener question that I have, which is, how do they address quality control of the therapy that is being provided? You want to take that question, Alyssa, for Recovery Record?
Yeah, so, you know, it's really about linking with their provider. And if they're using it in a self-help capacity, everything that we're providing them is evidence-based and shown to be effective and helpful. So to kind of answer your question in two different ways, you know, it's really trusting their clinician that they're already working with to utilize the, you know, app in an effective way, and making sure their clinician's licensed and, you know, has the specializations that they may need. And in the self-help capacity, it's stuff that's been proven to be helpful.
Right. And for you, Christy, I'm sure you must have been screened before you got hired by Talkspace. And was that fairly rigorous?
It was like a long onboarding process. It took like months, like at least a month or 2 months for me to like actually be like an approved Talkspace provider.
Well, I think the listeners will be happy to hear that, that it was not easy to do.
No.
And so tell me with Talkspace, how many months of your years have you been doing that?
I started in 2018, so...
So it's been a while.
Yes.
And do you find that as from the therapist side, is it just as gratifying to work with somebody via the app as it is to see somebody in person?
It's definitely different, but I was kind of amazed by how deep the relationship could be, actually, through the app. I wasn't expecting that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And why do you think that is?
I think it's just like... For me, it's actually like a shifting of how you think about therapy, because in reality, therapy is about relationships. So, like, I'm kind of thinking, like, through an app, like, even though it's an app, but, like, when clients actually takes the time to write, so we do this back-and-forth writing messages or video chatting. So a relationship is born by that. And also, like, having that accessibility, like, they feel like they can always share something with me, it's really helpful in building the relationship and trust as well.
When you say that you're texting back and forth, is it a single text a day, or is it multiple texts? I'm curious at how that works.
So clients can write any times, and like they can write me 10 different texts and or, you know, like however often they want to write. And then I do that as like I check in the morning and at night, and if they have written, I'll write them a message. So I usually do one long response.
Mm-hmm. And it's not canned, I take it. it's individualized.
They're
not like canned responses.
No, I actually read through what they share and take my time to reflect and, you know, kind of think about what I wanted to share with them, or sometimes guide them a little bit. And yeah, so it's not, definitely not. It's a real person writing.
Right. And is there a particular way that Talkspace wants you to respond, or is it left up to you?
It's pretty much up to me.
How you want to respond to the clients.
Yes.
And is there a limit to how many clients you can get?
I mean, like, if, yeah, Not really. Yeah, in the beginning, they have you limit to less than 20, but then now it's kind of open to, and I think it's a pretty huge number.
Yeah. And, yeah. And do you find that your clients are all over the place in terms of age and sort of professions and where they are in life?
Yes, pretty much from, like, my client case, though, it's from 20 to 50-something. So it's pretty a huge range, yeah.
And, Bar, you were talking about how around the world there are more countries that are using apps and using that kind of technology. Is it just for people of all ages, or are you finding that a particular demographic gravitates to using apps more?
Since they go across all demographics and, programs are being adapted based on people's reading levels and skills. So obviously you can develop a program that might work well in the U.S. but not so well in a population that isn't as literate or would prefer things in other visual pictures and so forth. But we just been involved in a big study in Europe called the iCare Project, which involves the implementation of apps in businesses, industry, schools, and universities, and they all have to be over 18 because it was part of a scientific study which they couldn't use adolescents. But the age range was huge, and there doesn't seem to be a big difference in terms of how well people do, just reinforcing what was said earlier. A friend of mine, we haven't really talked about the use of avatars and automated systems that aren't textual, where you're communicating, with a robot basically online. But a friend of mine did a study with the diabetes in Australia, where the population was mostly over age 60, and the men and women who were part of this study loved talking to this robot, even though they were told it was a very edgy Australian robot. He said, "Are you crazy? Why are you talking to me? I'm like a robot, And but the level of user satisfaction amongst the older people was really high. So I don't think it's age is a particular issue, but it depends a lot on how the program is designed and presented to people and what the goals of the individual are.
Well, it seems to also, talking about Australia and just the vastness of that country, that a benefit of an app might be that you could reach areas that really don't have good mental health care. I mean, here in the Bay Area, it seems like you could swing a cat and you could find a therapist. But, in a rural setting, it might be very difficult to access mental health care. And I know that's been a problem with the VA. Internationally, are you seeing that apps are being used a lot by people who live in places that they can't access mental health care at all?
Absolutely. The World Health Organization has this as one of their major directives, is to developing programs. And a lot of these programs really have to be self-help that are designed for people who, because almost everywhere people have phones that really don't have other kind of access. It's a great potential of the field. But I wouldn't minimize the use of these in rural areas in the United States. So, for instance, because of the success that this person had with depression in young people, we've started to look at places like Montana. We have an epidemic of suicide and depression in young people, many of whom are in rural areas and don't have access at all to care. The data from NIDA, we plotted where all of these folks were with eating disorders, and a good share of them were in locations where there wouldn't be any expertise to treat the problem or people particularly interested in them. So, part of the dream is, and I think a huge advantage of digital technology, is it really can create access to people pretty well anywhere. And with the modern algorithms, you begin to sort out what are the features or components that work for people anywhere, like in Africa or India or Montana. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to get too carried away with that, but the field is moving in that direction, and we're starting to see some pretty good results in places in the so-called low-income developing countries, where simple depression tools provided by apps are providing a really nice benefit to people.
Well, we have a question from a listener, which is, how do these apps address cultural differences among the patients, if they're used internationally? So let's with Recovery Record, it seems like there's a clinician sometimes, but do you account for the cultural differences of your patients?
So I'm so glad that this listener asked that. So our app has actually been translated into German and is used in Germany. And so we had to be really careful with translation because it's not just word for word. We really had to think about phrasing and how, someone in Germany may respond to a specific coping skill if it's worded in a certain way. And in terms of, just in the United States, an individual can identify as female, male, or non-binary when they're entering the app, and we do our best to have gender-neutral and, multiculturally appropriate responses and images that we show within the app. We're not perfect. And one of the things that we love to get is feedback from users and clinicians, and we take all of those into account. So, we'll get feedback that this is, not the most helpful, or can it be phrased differently? And we work on that and we make those changes.
And is the goal to kind of expand internationally beyond Germany and the like?
Oh, it's actually used in many different countries. It's used in Australia. It's used all over Europe. Yeah. So we're out there, and we'd love to continue to spread.
Yeah. Is Recovery Record going to stay in the eating disorder space, or are you looking to use, I think you mentioned another app that is part of your company?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. We've seen such success with the use of Recovery Record, and not just from our vantage point through these clinical trials, that we've gotten requests for other mental health concerns. And the app that we just recently released that is available for free on the App Store and Google Play is called Recovery Path, and that's for addiction.
Okay.
And so it functions in a pretty similar way as Recovery Record, that you can link with a provider if you're someone who's struggling with addiction. We've also added two additional apps. One is a friends and family supporter app that has a different function than the clinician app. It's really about sending positive affirmations and being that person that people can reach out to if they're in a moment of need. And then also a sponsor app or a mentor app. So if they're going to community meetings and they link up with someone that's part of their support network, they can link through Recovery Path and use that as their space for communicating and getting support and logging and all the stuff that Recovery Record offers.
And did you say that's on Google Play? Is it also on your iPhone?
Yeah, so it's available on Android and iPhone, and there's also a web interface. And same thing for Recovery Record. It can be used on the computer.
Mm-hmm. And is that the same with Talkspace? Is it an international organization? Do you find that it's – I think you mentioned that you have clients from overseas, right?
I do have clients overseas, but I think the provider is United States. And then I wanted to share that clients can request therapist to be like, say they wanted to work with someone that is from Asian background or African American background, they can request that, and then we do have a lot of different kind of therapists on site, so usually they'll be able to match with people that they feel like they can work with and understand the culture.
Well, it seems like what we've been talking about is apps can be effective. Bar, tell me this, in the next 5 to 10 years, what are going to be some of the big changes that we'll see in the ways therapy is being delivered?
I think that individual therapy will continue to be really important, but more and more therapists will be doing blended therapy with combinations of the use of apps and teletherapy. I think that the programs, the software underlying the transactions will get more sophisticated and make it more kind of economical at scale. I mean, one of the problems in the field is that if you do the kind of cool things that Recovery Record does and Talkspace does or Headspace does, it takes a fair amount of therapist time. And a lot of companies have struggled as to how they can then reach large numbers of populations if they make it too individual and require too much attention on the part of the therapist. So I think that we're going to be seeing a lot of these transactions, blends of automation where some of the text is actually created by computers and mixed with what happens with individuals. I think we're going to be seeing new models developing, too, that are quite exciting. We haven't even talked about virtual reality. There are a lot of companies around here like Limbix that are doing really incredibly interesting things. There are companies like X2AI that are developing chat boxes that can begin to supplement the therapeutic process. So I also think we're going to see a bit of a transformation where the consumer and the therapist work together a little bit differently, where it's more of a partnership but looking for resources and how they're going to improve and go forward. And a big issue in the whole app field is, and it was alluded to by what you were saying about Recovery Record, is how you begin to bring in people's social support and sponsorship in order to make the changes more substantial and lasting. And a big problem in general, looking globally at the app, is we have tended to deal with problems that are not some of the most serious ones. So we call a group of disorders that folks have a serious mental illness. And I think in the next 4 to 5 years, we're going to be seeing some incredibly interesting work where apps, for instance, may help homeless folks in various kinds of ways, or individuals with bipolar disorder. Or the other big problem is that most apps tend to focus on only one disorder, whereas most people have multiple disorders. So integrated programs that can address a variety of problems in a variety of ways are what's going to happen in the next 5 years. So I think it's incredibly exciting, this field, and it's, I think, exciting to be a therapist of all of the potential we can do with these kind of resources.
Well, the two therapists in the studio are excited to hear that they're not going to be unemployed in the next 10 years.
Phew.
In our last 2 minutes for our listeners, can you give us some advice, any of you, about what they should look for in an app that would be qualitative to make sure that they're downloading that something that probably will work for them? Christy?
I think you want to make sure the app that it's HIPAA compliant, so your privacy is respected, and also make sure the therapists are being screened properly.
Yeah. Alyssa?
I would also look to see what research has been done on the app, and, you know, because, people can just put an app out there and it might not have any science or clinicians that are part of the creation. So I would definitely look into that, and also look and see how many people have reviewed the app, you know, if it's only two versus, you know, right, 3,500, you know, just to see the uptake. You know, if 850,000 people are using an app and sticking with it, there's something going on there that's probably helpful.
That sounds right. And Barr, last word.
I would go to CyberGuide as my go-to place. Mm-hmm. It addresses all of the issues that have been mentioned. Mm-hmm. It's conservative, but I think that consumers looking at it will get a pretty good idea about the strengths and benefits, costs, privacy, and other issues. So CyberGuide with a P, if you're looking for an app, I'd start there.
Yeah, and we have that. That's CyberGuide, PSYBERguide.org.
Yes.
I think you also mentioned the VA has an app store. Is that right?
I was going to say, going to the VA app, you can just look at for the VA apps, and those are super apps, credible and free. That was just, thank you for saying that. Was the second thing I was going to suggest.
And that would be mobile.va.gov /appstore/mental-health.
Exactly.
Well, I think this has been really helpful for our listeners to hear about how therapy is being delivered in the brave new world. I'm glad that it's not algorithms and robots alone. We have some live folks on the phones, so that is really helpful. So thanks very much. And this has been City Visions on KALW. We'll have to leave it there. Our guests tonight were Alyssa Chaikoff, the Clinical Implementation Manager for Recovery Record. We've also heard from Christy Choi. She's a marriage and family therapist based in Berkeley and a Talkspace provider. And on the phone, we've had Dr. Barr Taylor, the Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences Emeritus at Stanford University and a Research Professor and Director of the Center for M-Squared Health at Palo Alto University. Thanks to all of you for joining me tonight. Appreciate
that.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, and to let you know what you to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit us at City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Debbie Kennedy. Tonight's show was produced by myself and Wendy Holcomb. And please join us next week when our host Ethan Elkind sits down with Sujatha Baliga, the director of the Restorative Justice Project at Oakland-based Impact Justice. So this is Grace Swan. Good night and have a great week.